The Water Values Podcast, session 135.
Welcome to the Water Values Podcast. This is the podcast dedicated to water utilities, resources, treatment, reuse, and all things water. Now here's your host, Dave McGimsey.
Hello and welcome to another session of the Water Values Podcast. As my daughter Sarah said, my name is Dave McGimsey and thanks so much for joining me. As always, have a great show for you today. We have a Bluefield on Tap segment with Reese Tisdale, and then we have a fantastic interview by Chris Peacock, who is, for those of you, for longtime listeners, you'll remember him from back in episode 31, and Chris has started up a new company, and he's going to tell us all about this company, which it's amazing what Chris has done. When I re-listened to the interview, I thought, wow, he's just doing great work. But before we get there, I do need to say thank you, thank you, thank you to all of you who have rated and reviewed the podcast. My goal was to hit 100 by the end of the year. I thought that was, you know, might be pushing it. We had 96 as of the last recording, and in the intervening couple of weeks, we are up to 101 ratings on Apple Podcasts. We got five more. Four of them are five stars. We got one four-star rating, and we got a fantastic review by Mike Thomas of the Georgia Association of Water Professionals on Apple Podcasts. He goes by WaterMike58, and he says, great podcast for the water industry. For someone who likes to stay current in my industry, this is a great resource for utility employees, consultants, and vendors. Mike Thomas, Georgia Association of Water Professionals. So, Mike, thank you for the great review on Apple Podcasts and for the five-star rating. Really appreciate it. And this just kind of brings out something I've kind of noticed, this trend of people leaving kind of who they are in the rating and the review. So we had Greg Pierce of the UCLA Luskin Center, who left a fantastic rating and review on Apple Podcasts. And Mike Thomas, now of the Georgia Association of Water Professionals, followed that up. That really speaks to me, because you know, these individuals who hold significant positions have left their names and things of that nature on their rating and review to let others know that this is a good podcast. And so thank you so much, guys. Really appreciate it. I can't tell you enough how thankful I am that you guys find this information that we put out every 2 weeks or so useful, and you're enjoying it and think it's good stuff. So again, thank you to everyone who's rated and reviewed the podcast. And if you haven't, what are you waiting for? Get out on Apple Podcasts. It's easy to rate it. I'd love it if you'd left a great review too. So thanks so much. So here we are. We have Reese Tisdale, who's going to talk with us a little about water in the ag sector, what he has noticed in terms of irrigation and things like that. And with that, let's kick it to Reese. Well, Reese, welcome back for another Bluefin on Tap session. How you doing?
I'm good. It's Red Sox won the World Series.
Oh, jeez. Oh, gosh. Oh, man. Well, congratulations to the Red Sox. You know, I'm a Mariners fan, and my season's usually over around the end of May. We hung around a little longer this year, but there's all, you know, we'll see.
I don't know. It never gets old.
Yeah. Well, let's get to the water sector. So what is on your mind? What kind of has caught your attention recently in the water sector?
I mean, as you know, we're looking at a whole list of different topics and themes in the water sector. What's happening? One thing that actually I think may line up with your guest that you're speaking to later, and that has to do with Jane, the India-based irrigation company that is recently acquired ET Water in California. It's really interesting to see what's happening. One part of my thinking is also in the commercial space, and sort of what commercial property owners and on the domestic side, where things are happening with water management. It's getting a little bit smarter, and it seems like California is the market to be, as usual.
Yeah. So what does that Jane acquisition of ET, what does that signify, or what kind of clues does that give us to where investment in smart water is headed?
Well, I think, you know, it's their fourth deal since 2015. So Jane has been building out It's North America based. Its revenues in North America as a whole have gone from about 10% in 2014, I believe, to 17% in 2018. I think a big part of that is sort of this growth in smarter irrigation, more advanced technologies and solutions, both in monitoring and water controls. And so what we've seen there is, you know, while their revenues have grown, their share in North America has grown. Big part of that, obviously, we're talking California, but this is something that's applicable in the rest of the U.S., particularly in the more arid parts of the U.S., where there has been drought. And quite honestly, advanced irrigation systems, it still remains a pretty small part of irrigation as a whole. It's about 8% of the U.S. market, which is different. To get put it in context, somewhere like Israel would be 95%. Yeah. So there's a lot of growth to be had in the U.S. And I think water as a whole is in the news. I think people are more aware of it, both from homeowners but also commercial property owners.
Yeah, I guess when I think of irrigation, I think of scarcity, right? Because if you got plenty that's falling from the sky, you don't need to irrigate. And with how all the climate change models that you see coming around, pretty much, you know, if I could sum them up, they say you're going to have long periods of no water and then really intense periods of water. So those extreme weather events are going to concentrate. And so, do you see kind of the climate models as driving some of this irrigation acquisition activity and irrigation growth?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. And I think part of it also is you're looking at what's happening in California. Regulators are more aware of it. They're trying to figure out what's happening with water withdrawals, but also more efficient use of water. I mean, I think like any, we've talked a lot about digital water strategies. Part of the first step is understanding the water flows and what the challenges are. And then the next step is becoming more efficient in using that data and analytics. So absolutely, it's kind of amazing right now, you know, whether it be California where, you know, there is arid, particularly in the Central Valley, but also the Central Coast. And then you're finding places like Venice right now, which are flooding. And it's going to change and there's going to be a lot of volatility. But yeah, water scarcity is the primary driver.
Yeah, and so you identify the ag sector as well as, you know, commercial properties, which, you know, not everyone thinks about. Do you have any thoughts on which of those two is kind of the bigger play?
Well, I think, you know, the commercial, that's going to happen. I mean, you're seeing new buildings. Obviously, the greenfield development is where you're going to see more activity. It's easier to install reuse systems, separate pipe networks into new build rather than retrofits. It's just a lot easier. So we've talked about it. We're seeing San Francisco as a market leader in this area. And there are a number, I think we track, you know, 35 to 40 companies providing different types of systems and solutions, mostly in California, but elsewhere. I think agriculture is the 800-pound gorilla when it comes to industrial water usage. It uses a lot of water. You know, it obviously sort of runs through the hydrologic cycle as it's used and evaporates and so forth. But I think people see that as a real opportunity. You know, is there a slow shift away from pivot irrigation to more advanced drip irrigation systems, but also monitoring? I mean, everything from companies are using drones to measure moisture in the soils to other sensors and new technologies. So I think, and also much of it is private. So they're privately run, privately operated. So there's, I think, companies, at least vendors, see it as an opportunity because it may move a little bit faster than you're seeing in contrast in what I would say the municipal water sector.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad you kind of characterized it as the 800-pound gorilla because I guess from my simple mind, you got to have the food supply, right? And that's where the ag comes in. Whereas the commercial properties, I would look at from an irrigation perspective, at least, you know, there's another alternative because they could xeriscape their areas, and so that would alleviate the need to even irrigate. So I guess it's kind of an economic model there. Well, awesome. Anything else in that sector that's kind of catching your eye?
I mean, there have been other deals that we've seen happen. I think we covered some deal flow. Mexichem acquired Netafim last year, so that was a big deal. So Mexichem, chemical company that, you know, Netafim is out of Israel. They bring a lot of experience into the sector. So that was obviously a play. And then we saw Lindsay that recently acquired a machine-to-machine learning company. I think it was Alexis. So there is activity happening there. I think, you know, I was actually having a conversation with someone last night at the Celtics game of all places, and we were talking about water and really the future of agriculture as a whole. So what is the impact of agriculture and how is that sector growing, but also what's the impact of what is its impact on water usage? So is that going to change? Not necessarily next year or the next 5 years, but what is it going to look like in 20 to 30 years? And so there's a lot happening in the space.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Reese, thanks again for your time today. You've been awesome as normal, but appreciate it. And happy holidays to you.
Yeah, you too.
All right. Well, as always, Reese Tisdale does a great job with the market insights provided by Bluefield Research on our Bluefield on Tap segment. Great stuff, as always. Reese, thank you so much for your for the time you put in on this and sharing some of your insights with us on the Bluefield on Tap segment. Now it's time to turn to our interview with Chris Peacock, who is absolutely fantastic. It's a wide-ranging interview. We go, you know, Chris started Aqua Oso Technologies recently, and he is in a unique space in the water sector, trying to identify water risk, trying to quantify water risk and to mitigate that water risk. And it's a really, again, a wide-ranging interview. I think you're going to learn a lot from Chris because he does a fantastic job. I'm kind of all over the place in terms of all these questions because there was so much going through my mind when the interview was going on. And Chris handled everything just, you know, impeccably. He did a great job. And without further ado, let's just get to it. Here is my interview with Chris Peacock. Well, Chris, welcome back to the Water Values Podcast. So glad you could come back on. Tell us a little about what you're doing these days. What's changed since we talked last?
Yeah, thanks, Dave. It's really great to talk to you again. It's been a little while, and I think like you, I've had significant changes in my life over the past few years.
Yeah.
Last time we talked, I was just getting ready to release the book that you contributed to. We launched that. We had really great success with the book, Damned If We Don't. It actually won a couple of awards, which was really cool to see. Shortly after that, we did a Water Energy Nexus Hackathon in San Francisco, which was really cool. Really spent a few years running around North America, working on the smart meter space and the building side. Talking a lot about smart meters and the ways in which technology is evolving in the water utility space with Fathom. But a couple of years ago, I saw a really interesting opportunity here in California to basically help better manage data in relationship to water resources. So I launched yet another company, Aqua Oso Technologies.
I think I chuckled over that. Can you say the name again, please?
Yeah, the name is Aqua Oso Technologies.
Okay. So like Water Bear.
The Water Bear.
The Water Bear, yeah.
a bit of a nod to California.
Yeah. All right. So tell us a little about Aqua Oso.
Yeah, so Aqua Oso is really focused on building a water-resilient future. I took a different approach to building a business this time. We're a software company, but we're also a public benefit corporation, which means that we understand there's a social component as we talk about water. We are a for-profit entity, but really what we're focused on right now is leveraging machine learning, data science, and powerful mapping tools to help the agricultural economy reduce and mitigate water-related risks. California, as many people know, it's experienced some real significant weather events over the past few years, going from extreme droughts to extreme flooding in certain areas. And so we've been able to build some really interesting technology and tools to help investors and bankers and farm managers better understand, identify, and monitor water-related risks.
All right. So, I mean, that sounds very interesting. Now, for the layperson out there, you know, just saying, oh, there's water risk in California, that's one thing. But let's do a little dive into the types of risks that you're seeing that Aqua Oso can kind of, you know, help quantify and mitigate against. So can you kind of dive into the various segments that you're looking at there?
Yeah, absolutely, Dave. So at the highest level, there's some really great tools out there like WWF's Water Risk Filter or WRI's Aqueduct, which helps identify kind of changes in water and risk in water at a global macro level. And so what we found was it was really challenging to identify specific water risks all the way down to an individual piece of property. So in California today, what we're seeing are a combination of not just weather events, but also policy changes in the ways in which groundwater is being managed and monitored here in California. So we look at everything from weather events to irrigation districts and the way irrigation districts are allocating water across the state. We're looking at the groundwater changes and the allocations that are starting to come into play here in California, which is very new to the state. It's interesting for California, which is a state really well known for being environmentally sustainable and focused on the environment. Water has been one of those few things, at least groundwater, one of those few things that hasn't been well managed up until recently. So we're seeing a bit of whiplash across the state as new groundwater rules are coming into effect in the management of those rules. So as a company, we're tracking those regulations. And we're really what we're doing is we're tracking the implications of those regulations across the agricultural sector. So certain parts of California are going to have a reduction of the amount of groundwater that they can use for pumping onto farms and fields, which is going to have a significant impact not just on the growers in the area, but the financial capabilities of the lenders that have historically been lending money to the area.
Right.
And what we're seeing are our banks and lending institutions are getting calls from the regulators now. The investors are getting calls from their investment groups because they keep seeing these headlines about California water and drought and Sigma and all of these crazy things. And people are trying to get their arms wrapped around what that actually means from both an investment and a lending perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a great insight. You know, in terms of California agricultural, can you kind of talk about the market in general? Because it's a bigger market than I think many of us think about. You know, when we hear ag, you know, a lot of us think, oh, Corn Belt, you know. But you take the drive south of San Francisco and drive through all the, you know, all the farm fields and things like that. I mean, it gives you an appreciation for California's ag footprint. So can you talk about kind of the ag market just in general?
Yeah, absolutely. So California is very different from the Midwest and other states. I forget the exact number of crops, but there's hundreds of different crops that are grown in California, and a lot of them are specialty crops. So table grapes, wine grapes, almonds, walnuts, pistachios, citrus, cotton, like the gamut runs across the board in terms of what is grown here in California. And the value of that market is significant. I think farm gate value over the past few years has been $46 billion or so across the state. So there's a lot of money that's invested in California, and land prices in California are significantly different than what you might be able to see in other parts of the country. I actually just came off of a roadshow with Farmer Mac here in California, and they were talking about some of the investment opportunities and lending opportunities in California. So just for some perspective, like some of these lenders are lending up to $50 million for operations in land here in California. And if you translate that financial capability into the Midwest, you can buy almost an entire county of land for that. Whereas here in California, you can buy, you know, a medium-sized farm. So the value of the crops are significantly higher in California than they are in other parts of the country because of the specialty that we see here.
Yeah,
and also because of that, we see more intense uses of water as well here in California. Almonds are probably one of the largest users of water, but it's also got one of the highest economic impacts. So trying to find the balance of where water can and should go across the state is definitely the latest challenge that California farmers are dealing with.
Yeah, so when you kind of were introducing this subject, you were talking about, you know, the groundwater regulation, some of the changes that are coming on. I would like to explore some of the trends that you have seen in water in California, and you know, how, let's just say, how the trends in the digital technology to serve those water trends. Can you kind of flesh that out for us?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the last time we spoke, Dave, I gave you kind of a brief overview of how I got into water, right? Which was building water markets in northern Arizona. And so there's an interesting corollary between Arizona and California. In the early 80s, Arizona put into place groundwater regulations and created classes and classifications of groundwater rights in the state. California, while they're not necessarily creating a new set of groundwater rights, they are finally putting the regulations in place to manage groundwater. And so what we're seeing in California is now the ability to reallocate water across the state from a groundwater perspective, which has created really interesting opportunities on the technology side. You know, a few years ago, if I liken this to the water utility space, which you're very familiar with, you know, smart technologies were having a hard time really getting a footprint because people were having a hard time understanding the ROI of those technologies. But in the recent years, we're starting to see, right, in the utility space, a greater uptick in smart meters being placed out in the fields and out at the homes, and the data coming back now has multiple places to go to be analyzed, right? When you look at some of the M&A activity in the water utility space with Valor, when you look at some of the artificial intelligence coming into play like Imagine, you can really see how the data can be transitioned and transferred into making better decisions. And so we're starting to see the same opportunities here in California. So as groundwater becomes monitored more frequently, there's similar opportunities to manage and monitor wells in terms of where water is going and how it's getting there, putting devices out in the field to identify the crop use of water and the patterns of that crop use. We're seeing more and more weather stations being placed out in the fields and soil controls out in the fields. But the problem that the space is really having today is, what do you do with all of that data? And it's the same problem that almost every industry has encountered over time. I think the water utility space is finally figuring out what to do with all of that data. And the agricultural space is just now kind of on the edge of figuring out what to do and where that data can go.
Yeah.
So for us, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, no, go ahead. I don't mean to interrupt you, so please continue on.
I know I can get winded at times, Dave, so jump in.
No problem. Believe me, I'll jump in if I need to, but I'm sorry for interrupting you.
Yeah, not a problem. So what we did at AquaOSO was start to build a data and technology platform to not just gather the data, but actually map it as well. So we've taken 20-plus data sets that exist in the public domain around water rights and groundwater levels, well information, crop patterns. We've put all of that into a geospatial database, and we've gone out and collected our own information as well around allocations across the state, weather information, and other proprietary data that we've been able to bring into the platform that now allows us to very holistically not just put the data sets together so that they make more sense, but actually geospatially map them as well so that people can not just make better decisions, but identify where those decisions should be made.
Right. And so I assume with your technology background, that was kind of the inspiration for starting this company, you know, essentially marrying up the data with, you know, the digital platform and obviously water.
Absolutely. I mean, after 20 years in the water space and a decade on the technology side, it was a really nice opportunity to find a way to not just give back to the broader community, but build a real business that can scale over time. Right? This is now my fourth business. Funny enough, this is the first one that's a pure tech play. All of the other companies have been more on the consulting side. And so it's been an interesting learning curve for me, not just growing and scaling a technology company in the water space, but doing it in the agricultural side and on the banking side, which is really new to me and really exciting. It's a nice opportunity to learn about other aspects of water that I hadn't always been deeply involved in.
Yeah, and so can you I want to explore the notion of risk from the banking perspective. So why does the bank need to, I mean, I think common sense will dictate, you know, why a bank should understand risk. But can you talk about why the, you know, what the data that you're now collecting and compiling and sorting and organizing and you know, how is that being able to, or how is a bank able to use that information to understand risk at a, you know, a more basic level?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the easiest way to describe it is if you look at Experian or TransUnion and the FICO scores that banks use to help identify whether or not an individual or corporation has the right amount of credit capabilities on the lending side. If you look at the makeup of those scores, there's 20, 30 different things that the scores look at in terms of creating a number. And so we're doing the same thing on the water side. We've got 20 different data sets that we're looking at to identify, if you will, the credit worthiness of the water from a lending perspective. So in some ways, we're kind of creating a FICO score for water, if you will. So like anywhere in the water space, the data is highly fragmented on the agricultural side. So banks have been having a really hard time identifying and understanding where risk really lies. They understand that there's risk in water from an agricultural perspective. They understand that if there's a drought, there's a likelihood that farmers and growers may or may not be able to make some of their payments because the production side might not be where it needs to be. Where they've had a harder time, however, is identifying specifically where that risk may be as they're making loans, or inside of their existing loan portfolio. So we've been able to give them tool sets to, one, take a look at new loans coming in the door and identify how risk could potentially play out from a water perspective, which has a really large impact on the grower's ability to produce the financials that they say they're going to produce in the underwriting process.
Right.
And we'll also give them, we've also given them the tools to look back at the broader portfolio that's already in existence and help identify where they can mitigate risk by maybe shifting their loans in other geographic areas.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds very interesting. I'm kind of curious, is there a way to kind of project into the future? I know that because when they're issuing these loans, I don't know how they're packaged in terms of, you know, what the term for repayment is. But I would imagine that climate change and, you know, future risk of water is kind of a significant issue. And how do you address that aspect of it?
Yeah, that's a really great question. And it's one that we get all the time on the banking and the investment side of what is the water situation going to look like in 5 to 10 years? And no one really has a silver bullet for that. But we can absolutely use machine learning and some artificial intelligence to start doing predictive analytics. So we're not necessarily telling a bank or an investor where water will be in 5 to 10 years, but we are able to create different scenarios and stress tests to help them understand the potential implications of the loans that they're giving out. So at least they have a better understanding of if certain scenarios happen where, in the state of California, let's say we enter another drought, what are the potential implications based on prior experiences and future capabilities? So these are all things that we're building into our tool sets. And it's definitely not an easy thing to go do, but with the state of technology where it is today and the ability to aggregate large sets of data, we are able to get some pretty good analytics in place to help them make better decisions, which, one, helps them identify where they want to make loans, and two, helps them identify how they price those loans in higher risk areas.
Yeah, I would imagine that also it's going to factor a lot into, you know, the terms that the agricultural producer can get out of the bank and things like that. So I think this is going to just give more certainty around that loan, and so I think that how that information is used is going to be really, really interesting. And I guess my thought would be that whoever doesn't have this information is going to be at an information disadvantage and may be able they're not going to be able to negotiate as good a deal on the loan as they might otherwise. Has anyone kind of talked with you about that?
We've had a number of discussions, and so a few trends that we're seeing in the agricultural space here in California. One is some lenders are looking at the space and it's just too risky for them. So we're actually seeing some lenders back out of providing loans here in California because they're just not comfortable with the potential risk on the water side. We're seeing other lenders go all in and say, this is what we do. We lend to the growing community. We're going to continue lending to the growing community. We just want to understand what the risk profiles are going to look like. And so for them, we're seeing them prepare in advance, which I think is a really smart strategy, right? Being able to understand the potential scenarios in the future, I think, gives you much more capability and ability to make better decisions in both the short term and the long term. So the folks that we're seeing having higher rates of success are the ones that are planning for the future, that are identifying the data and the information that they need in order to predict risk better. We're seeing them have better capabilities on the lending side and building stronger relationships, quite honestly, with their growers.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, I mean, that kind of partially answered my next question, which was, you know, how are you guys kind of working with all the different players in this industry to help them make better decisions? And so I think you partially answered that, but to the extent you have more information, could you please kind of push that out there?
Yeah, so like anything with water, collaboration is really important. And for me and for the company that we've built, collaboration is a core component to what we've been building. For 2 years, my partners and I ran across the Central Valley of California to Northern California, Southern California, talking to hundreds of growers and bankers and investors and irrigation district managers and bureaucrats across the state. And what we were able to identify was that there is no single entity that has one single solution across the state. And so what we've been able to do is really work collaboratively with a number of stakeholders to bring the information into our platform. So we're not working just with investors or lenders. We're also working with the growers directly. We're giving them tools to make better decisions on the farms. We're working with various state agencies to help them move their data more swiftly to the people who need it. And we're working with local agencies as well who are responsible now for managing groundwater. And we're giving them tools to better manage their groundwater resources. So across the state and across the work that we're doing, we are working with multiple stakeholders because it's important for everybody to really understand and interact in order to manage this one single resource that we have.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. I think the more information, the better. So we've kind of been drilling down on information and data and how all this impacts water. Let's drill back up. And I want to ask you kind of a more panoramic question, so to speak. And that is kind of what has all this kind of taught you? Or how does this impacted your global view on water risk?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, Dave. My perspective on water, I've always thought was fairly broad, but I found a few blind spots, to be honest. I realized over the course of the past couple of years that water risk is much broader than we typically think about or talk about. The implications of just on the agricultural side, the implications of water risk are huge. As we start thinking about how we need to continue to feed a growing population around the globe, as we look at the fact that water supplies will outstrip demand over the next 20 to 30 years, those play real significant roles in terms of how we better manage our water resources. And a lot of the times what I've been seeing are very specific technologies that solve very specific problems. And that's good and needed in this space. But I think like anything in the water sector, the discussion needs to continue to evolve in the form of how does water play in the overall circular economy? So we're seeing this on the water reuse side, right? Like we can use water more than one time. And typically the discussion around water is a discussion of one or two instances of use of water, but not how water cycles through the entire ecosystem. And so I think there's major opportunities for the urban environments and the agricultural environments and the environments themselves to interact more closely, not just at a local scale, but at a global scale. And there's some interesting groups doing some really great work in that space. Our goal ultimately is to scale the business, not just across agriculture in the West and in the United States, but also around the globe and across multiple industries. The scarcity issues that we're facing and the risk that we're facing from a water perspective touches almost every single manufacturing environment, production environment, food safety environments. And so we see tremendous opportunity to increase the ability to have real discussions and change the ways in which we manage water around the globe.
Right, right. Let's bring it back down and talk about some of the things you indicated there in terms of like recycled water, things like that. I want to explore how that factors into the better, quote, better decisions that growers are making. You know, is a bank going to be more willing to lend based on the data that you're kind of looking if the grower is using a more sophisticated irrigation model, for example, you know, drip irrigation versus flood irrigation or something like that. I mean, how have you guys been able to drill down and figure out how that impacts water risk?
Yeah, we're actually doing a few studies right now with some universities in that space, but we're definitely seeing on the lending side a deeper desire and a better uptake of lending activity on those farms and with those growers who are able to leverage technology to better service their farms. In some cases in California, it still makes sense to actually flood irrigate because there's groundwater recharge capabilities in certain areas. And so I think the tricky part right now in California is identifying those areas where flood irrigation actually makes sense versus drip irrigation. And I think the other thing we're seeing now is more of a trend for identifying the actual consumptive use of plants as opposed to throwing out general numbers and looking at, you know, looking at where the water goes in multiple facets as opposed to assuming all of that water just is going to crop growth. But I think we're also facing, and not just in California but in other parts of the country, serious issues around nutrient runoff from farms. So there's a lot of opportunity for farmers and growers and technology companies to help mitigate those kinds of risks. But overall, I think the lending community and the growing community, we're seeing more and more adoption on the farms of smarter irrigation technologies to reduce the amount of water that is needed on the farm. And so it's used a bit more efficiently and effectively.
Yeah. Hey, how does the crop that is grown play into all this, you know, because if you're growing alfalfa, which is pretty, you know, water intensive from what I understand, you know, that's probably not as it's not as valuable a crop as say an almond, which might use, you know, just as much water. So how does the crop that is being grown factor into, the whole risk equation?
So the risk equation now in California and the Central Valley in particular, which has a number of hard crops like almonds, the real issue right now is identifying what parts of the Central Valley are going to end up being fallowed. So I think we're going to see a transition from kind of lower value crops into the higher value crops. We'll see some farmland that ends up getting fallowed over time. Just because there's not enough water to support all of the farmland currently in production. There's some really interesting studies right now going on to help identify what percentage of farmland may go out of production over time. But from what I've heard and what we've started to see is that from an economic standpoint, we don't think there's going to be a huge economic loss across the state, just a production loss in terms of different types of crops being farmed. So people are definitely looking at the economics more of what is being farmed and where the water is going. I think it'd be really interesting to start to see not just the water that's embedded in the various farms and the various fruits coming off the farms, but also the energy embeddedness and the economics of all of that. Because I think it would tell a really interesting story of economic viability in agriculture.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. So Chris, you've done a great job. Are there things that I have not asked you that you think would be important to relay to the listener?
So I think one of the most exciting things for me personally isn't just that we now have a really cool business in the ag space and water, kind of at the nexus, right, of agriculture, water, and finance. But there's an entirely new story around what it takes to build a startup in the water sector. And I think we found an interesting path where traditionally startups in the water sector have a really hard time finding a foothold and growing and developing a business. We've, I think, been very fortunate in that we have a really great team. I've got 5 full-time team members now. We've essentially bootstrapped our company to revenue, which is incredibly hard to do, and I'm not sure I would suggest a lot of people go and do it. I think there's other ways in order to build a business. But it's been really good for us, and I think I've learned a lot along the way. And so I think a few things that might be coming out of this, in addition to just a really solid business, are some more thoughts around what it takes to build a startup in the water sector and what it means to be a waterpreneur in the space. So there's probably another book in the future. Eventually, I'd like to loop back around to all of the folks that participated in the first book. I think it'd be great to see where everybody is at. But more than anything, I'd just like to encourage all of the listeners to just continue doing what they're doing and continue to make an impact and continue to take action, because that's what really matters the most, is actually doing things rather than talking about them. And I think, Dave, you're a great proponent of this, getting folks on your podcast that really helps showcase what people are doing to make a difference in the world of water. So I commend you on that, and thank you for doing that for the industry.
You bet. I'm happy to do it, and I'm happy to have great people like you come on and be willing to share their experiences and help spread that message, because I have the easy part, right? I just ask the questions, and people like you are charged with, you know, really being the mouthpiece to get out the message. So I thank, you know, you, and, you know, this is your second stint on, and it's been over 100 episodes since we had you last on. So I can't believe it took me this long to get you back on. So, well, Chris, I just want to say thank you so much for coming on and sharing some of your time with us. Really appreciate it. And let's catch up sooner the next time than when we let it go this last time.
That sounds great, Dave. Thank you a lot.
You bet. Talk to you soon, Chris.
All right, talk
bye.
To you later.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that interview with Chris Peacock of Aqua Oso Technologies. As you can tell, Chris does a fantastic job. I think he's really found a niche here. And I can't wait to hear how it goes, because this just seems so important and such, you know, as he kind of recognized a data fragmented sector, just like, you know, the utility industry is fragmented. Well, the water information industry is fragmented, and all these, you know, all these market participants are out there trying to figure things out. And he's really doing a great job, you know, culling information, you know, getting the right information in front of the right people to make the right decisions, so that we can use water in the best possible way. So, kudos to Chris for coming up, from thinking outside the box, for getting Aqua Oso going in California in the water ag economy. He just does a great job. Well, you can check out the show notes for this episode at thewatervalues.com/pod135. Leave a comment on those show notes to let me know what you thought about the interview, or you can email me at david@thewatervalues.com. You can also tweet at me at DTM1993, and you can tweet about the podcast using the hashtag watervalues. And please do me a favor, as I said at the top of the show, please rate and review the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, and any other podcast directory that you listen to it on. That would really be appreciated. Just a great way to help others find out about the podcast and why you think it's an important podcast. Well, in closing, please remember to keep the core message of the Water Values podcast in mind as you go about your daily business. Water is our most valuable resource, so please join me by going out into the world and acting like it.
You've been listening to the Water Values Podcast. Thank you for spending some of your day with my dad and me.
Thank you for tuning in to the disclaimer. I'm a lawyer licensed in Indiana and Colorado, and this podcast does not establish an attorney-client relationship with you or anyone else. Information in this podcast should not be considered legal advice. Further, this podcast is not a solicitation for professional employment. I'm just a lawyer who finds water issues interesting and who believes greater public education about water issues is necessary. And that includes enhancing my own education about water issues, because no one knows everything about water. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.